PQRST. Goodness sakes, a robot saying the alphabet. What cousining is this? Well, if you were watching... By the way, welcome to PQRST, Parody Quips, Rants, and Storytelling. And if you listened to the previous episode, you know exactly why we had a robot bless us with the ABCs, because of what's coming up in our movie nitpicking segment. But before we get to any nitpicking, as often happens, I have a rant. And this episode's rant is about personal responsibility. But before I talk about, well, before I do my ranting, I'm going to tell a story. Because storytelling is part of PQRST. So it was about a week ago. We got, like an inch of snowfall. Nothing significant or so I would have thought. But anyway, I am awakened about 5:30. It sounded like somebody had fallen down the stairs. There was a thud and a thud that was kind of muted. Turned out later it was because it was outside, was the muting. But I thought that Isaac, my son, had perhaps climbed out of his crib and wandered into the hallway and fallen down the stairs. He is climbing on things. He can now climb onto the couch, onto his train table. Things that used to be out of his reach because they were on end tables are not anymore, and so that's fun. But anyway, it wasn't Isaac, because there was no subsequent crying, which of course there would have been. And so I didn't think much of it. Figured I just imagined the sound. Wasn't quite sure I'd heard anything, but a minute or so later, the dog barks. And that still is not conclusively proof that something has happened, because he sometimes barks at random imaginary objects. But it was enough noise to stir the baby. And since the baby's like, I want to get up, I figured I'd go and make the baby's bottle, see if he'd go back to sleep. Well, as I'm looking out the window onto the new fallen snow, what to my wondrous eyes do appear but a piece of our fence that has been knocked down by someone. So the sound I heard, I'm pretty much 100% certain, was the sound of a car skidding, hitting the curb, hitting the fence, knocking a piece of it down. The fun part was the driver of the car decided to back up and drive away. Now, we found out later, he was stupid in this, because in doing so, he left behind his entire front bumper. And as those of you who live in Colorado know, front bumpers often have front license plates on them. So I went out to survey the damage. The fence belongs to the HOA, so I don't think anybody was hurt. If it was only the driver. Not that I want him hurt either, but I don't think anyone was. And, you know, it's a corporation that owns the fence, so I didn't lose anything but perhaps a little sleep. But anyway, to finish the story, I go outside and I write down the license plate number, and I call the police, and I didn't give them the number at first. I just said, hey, there's the fence been knocked down, come on out, take a look. Well, before they could get out and take a look, roughly within the hour, so by 6:30, I also happened to be in my son's room and could look out the window and see this, Subaru SUV, a Forester or an Outback, not an SUV, wagon, late model Subaru wagon pulls up. Somebody gets out, gets the bumper, puts it in their car, and then they drive away. Almost as if they wanted, whoever took the bumper was connected to the person that did the damage, and they wanted to conceal the evidence of their crime. Unfortunately for them, I had already written down the license plate number, I gave it to the police, and justice ensued not long after. The police called back, and it turned out, to no one's surprise, that the driver who knocked down part of the fence was indeed a teenage boy. He was on his way to, well, young boy, I don't know if they said teenage. Young boy on his way to work, freaked out, left the scene. And, you know, I understand freaking out. I understand, I certainly have no stones to throw at anyone for slitting for bad grammar, for sliding on ice and knocking into things. I will lay claim to this, as I have, I think, on a previous episode. I have personally separated the right front wheel from my car, off the car from the rest of it, twice. Once with a 280ZX, because I skidded on a right-hand turn that turned out to be slippery because they'd put the mag chloride down, and yet the snow hadn't fallen, so it was slippery by surprise, and I slid across a curb and hit a post and took the left front wheel off, and then again in a German-made car. I hate even thinking about that one, where I, again, with a right-hand turn, it was cambered downhill, and I was going a little too fast, and I went over a curb, and I snapped a wheel off. I've done it twice, and that's, I have slid off the road probably a dozen times, most of those when I was a teenage idiot, or a young 20-something idiot, so I have no stones to throw about the sliding, or the damage. Where the rant comes in is the, I'm going to get back in my car and drive away, and then even more so, the, because that's, in the moment, freaked out teenager, I can't get behind it, but I understand it. But the premeditated hour later where a friend or a family member or somebody comes along and grabs the bumper, say, hey, stupid, you left evidence behind, let's go get that, so hopefully we can get away with this and not have to take responsibility for our actions, that makes me very, very, very upset and very sad. It turned out that the car that did the damage did not have insurance, again, to no one's real surprise, and they're... Hopefully the family that owns the car, there was talk of a grandmother with 8 children, they're probably just trying to get by. But while I pity them, if you're driving without insurance, you're breaking the law. If you can't afford insurance, I'm sorry, there's got to be a job you can walk to. There's public transportation. There are ways to get things done without having to break the law, without having to drive away from damage that you've caused. And hopefully nobody be the wiser, because this it's a huge problem in our society, the idea that if nobody saw it, maybe I can get away with it. I hear about guys crashing cars and trying to flee the scene. There was one guy involved in an altercation, tried to run away, left his wife and newborn child in the car. Left them behind, ran away. People steal cars and then participate in street racing, and then when they crash the cars, try to run away from them. It's, take responsibility for your actions, okay? You know what? I have gotten speeding tickets. Because I was speeding, I paid the speeding tickets. You know, I accepted the fines, and I'm trying actually not to speed so much anymore. When I snapped the wheel off the 280ZX many, many moons ago, I took out a post in doing so. Yeah, I didn't flee the scene. I didn't unscrew my license plates and run away or try to pretend it hadn't happened. I will admit, in that situation, I couldn't have driven away if I wanted to because the car only had 3 wheels at that point. But you don't run away when you do something wrong, all right? If you're going to break the law and you get caught, then there's consequences. If you break the law, accept that there are consequences or don't break it. So just grow up out there. If you're busy not taking responsibility for your actions, whatever those actions might be, grow a pair and knock it off. Because we need people to have some sense of honor and to take responsibility for their actions. If a man's word means nothing, if you are too much of a coward or too selfish or too arrogant or too prideful to accept responsibility when you make mistakes, then you're a child, and children should not be running corporations, should not be driving automobiles, should not be married. So, that's my rant. Take responsibility for your actions. Anyway, having said all that, we get into this week's nitpicky movie. And for those who are like, what is he talking about? I wrote a book series, Nitpicking the Top 50 Grossing Movies of All Time. And by nitpicking, I mean not only, hey, wait a minute, the red car that he pulled up in, suddenly it's white now. They screwed that up. Or the water level in the drinking glass is going up and down throughout this scene. But also, seriously, that doesn't make any sense, given the plot that you've already told us about. Or wait a minute, movie, you're breaking your own rules. That sort of thing. It's nitpicking. It's fun. You'll see as you come along. And this week's movie is, number 47 out of the 50, is Iron Man. And now you know why we started off with a robotic voice. And before I get to nitpicking, thank goodness for Iron Man. I'm a big fan of what Marvel is doing, and to a lesser extent, DC, because I grew up in the 80s and the 90s. I have, far back as I can remember, been a big fan, as many guys are, of the superhero genre of my comic books. And there were so many bad superhero movies in the 80s and the 90s. On the DC side, Superman 1 and 2, great films. But then they went ahead and made 3 and 4, which are terrible. Batman 1 and 2, the ones with Michael Keaton, pretty good. But then they went ahead and they made 3 and 4, which are execrable. Just so awful. And it wasn't just DC. Oh, and by the way, Supergirl. Exactly. It wasn't just DC doing this. If you don't remember Captain America that came out in 1990, that's okay, because nobody does. If you don't remember the Fantastic Four movie that came out in, like, 91, you are forgiven, because nobody does. There were several Hulk movies in the late 80s. There was a couple of Punisher movies, and on it goes. And so, and even into the new millennium, the first two retry at making Hulk movies, those didn't come off too well. But Marvel started to figure out their stuff. The Spider-Man series, it's funny to think how little I care about the Tobey Maguire movies now, considering how good the Andrew Garfield ones. Oh, and by the way, we're having yet another Spider-Man movie with yet another person in the cape and the cape and cowl. Well, just the cowl part, because Spider-Man doesn't have a cape. Daredevil. Yeah, the movie sucked, and I wanted it to be so good, because Daredevil's one of the best Marvel guys, but the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movies were pretty good, even though I don't care for them so much now that Andrew Garfield came along. And Iron Man. Oh, did they do Iron Man well. So, they put together a good film. Thank you, Marvel, for putting together good films, and the way you tie them together and wait until the end to see a little bit more, it's a little self-serving, but when they do it so well, and you can, you know, watch the extras on, say, YouTube, so you don't actually have to go and sit through, say, Thor to see the extra little bit that leads into Avengers 2 or whatever. I got no complaints. Now, I do complain about movies that take liberties with comic books, but I'm going to save most of that for Spider-Man. All right, so let's get into the actual nitpicking. So Tony Stark is, they established that he sells weapons and that, you know, he's a warmonger. I've always wanted to mong something. There's warmongers, there's fishmongers. I want to mong something. Anyway, so he is off in the kibbutz somewhere, and he's in a convoy. And at 2 minutes and 32 seconds into the movie, the Hummer, 10 feet in front of Stark's Hummer, explodes. And they cut to a wide shot, and the Hummer that just exploded is still there, and the one in front of it is still there, but the one Stark is driving, or riding in, has disappeared. 3 minutes and 11 seconds in. So Tony Stark finds himself alone and unarmored in the middle of a ferocious firefight. Why is he being transported this way? Why is it a 4 or 5 Humvee convoy taking this incredibly important person? Couldn't he have gotten himself airlifted out of hostile country? I mean, look, Bruce Wayne would have gotten himself airlifted up. 4 minutes and 43 seconds. This is a kudos and not a nit. I live it to death. I really enjoy when movies go the extra mile. A lot of times in movies, if somebody pulls up a newspaper, the headline is important, and all the words underneath, it's just gibberish, or the same word, you know, same couple words repeated over and over, because it's only up for a second, and you're not going to be able to read it. But, and I have seen even some comic books where somebody looks at a newspaper and the headline is important and the rest is gibberish. And that, you can take all the time in the world to see that it's gibberish. Well, there's a magazine page and a newspaper article on screen for like a second here at 4 minutes and 43 seconds. And if you freeze frame it, it's really hard to read, but there are actual stories. So kudos to the producers. 5 minutes, 58 seconds. The explosions that have happened, we flash back to how he got to where the explosions happened, and so we see Tony Stark being given the Apogee Award, and there's this surprise and confusion that Tony Stark is not there to receive the award. This guy is, like, one of the smartest and richest and most powerful and influential people in the world. I guarantee somebody knows where Bill Gates is every second of the day. Somebody knows where Brad Pitt is every second of the day. The idea that Tony Stark can just suddenly disappear and it's a huge surprise because nobody knows where he is, I don't buy it. 8 minutes and 53 seconds. So Tony Stark, as he leaves the casino, meets this tough, no-nonsense Vanity Fair reporter. And she is determined to pin him to the table for his war profiteering. And then 5 seconds later, she wants to go to bed with him. does this make any logical sense? I mean, it's the James Bond trope that it's amazing how when somebody needs to partner up with James Bond or somebody comes against him to challenge him, it's always a beautiful woman. And here we have the beautiful woman who just, of course, succumbs to Tony Stark's charms and goes to bed with him. Maybe I'm complaining because this sort of thing just doesn't happen to me, although, yes, it did. It happened to me once, and her name is Tiffany, and she's my wife, so I take it back. But she wasn't trying... You know, let's just move on. 9 minutes and 48 seconds. Here's a bit of a social comment. When we see Tony Stark in the convoy with the soldiers, he says, hey, I went 12 for 12 with Maxim's calendar models. I boinked, if you'll forgive the expression, 12 calendar models in a year. Whoop-de-doo for him. All the soldiers think that's great, including the female one. She doesn't cry, you know, foul, harassment, anything. So it's totally fine that Tony Stark is a philanderer and sleeps with anything he can catch. But the female reporter who decides to sleep with Tony in the morning, Pepper Potts calls her trash. She says, I'm going to take out the trash, meaning the Vanity Fair reporter. That seems really unreasonable, you know? Either you can sleep with anybody you want or you can't, but, you know, how is it okay for Tony and not for the reporter? More of this, 14 minutes, 11 seconds in. Our hero, ladies and gentlemen, Tony Stark's personal aircraft even has a stripper pole that comes out of the ceiling. I mean, it must have come out of the ceiling, because in the earlier non-sex addict shots, it's not there. And just, come on. Filmmakers, do we need this? I submit the recent, not the Batman vs. Superman movie, but the recent Christopher Nolan Batman movies as a much better example of, okay, yes, Bruce Wayne is a billionaire playboy, but he's not crass. It's not ridiculous. This is ridiculous. Grungy nitpicking time, 15 minutes and 8 seconds in. Tony Stark reveals to the Vanity Fair reporter that his father worked on the Manhattan Project, also known as the atomic bomb. So here, at 15 minutes in, as Stark talks about the weapon you only need to fire once, he says, that's how my dad did it, indicating the Manhattan Project only needed to be fired once. Well, they dropped that bomb twice. That's why I say it's a grungy nit. Stark has been captured, and he wakes up in his cell, and he has a friend there. 17 minutes, 25 seconds in. There's Stark and the Doc. They're both prisoners. Neither is trusted. And yet the Doc has a razor. Just a tip. If you're ever going to incarcerate someone, you don't let them have a razor. Because there's lots of nasty things you can do with that. If you're new to the nitpicking, I give out the Will Award once a movie to the just most outrageous, ridiculous plot oversight or conundrum that the movie offers, and this one came in pretty early. 18 minutes, 45 seconds. What is this? That is an electromagnet hooked up to a car battery, and it is keeping the shrapnel from entering your heart. My apologies for the Indian accent. So, he's got a magnet that's keeping enough tension on the metal fragments so that they don't kill him. This magnet is pulling the fragments back. And that's just ridiculous. I know there has to be a thing for another thing, but it's still ridiculous. I'm sorry, I'm not going to buy the magnet pulling the fragments out of his heart. I'm sorry, I'm just not. And in the comics, just, you know, for the sake of argument, there's a similar monitor. It's a congenital heart defect that he's monitoring. And it wouldn't make sense in the cave for him to suddenly have this thing if it wasn't a reason for it, but I don't buy it. So 20 minutes and 13 seconds in, the Afghanistani cave. I think it's Afghanistan. I'm going to call it Afghanistan. If it's not, you will just have to forgive me. They're in, as previously stated, an Afghanistani cave, but the terrorist leader wants Stark to build him a state-of-the-art, top-of-the-line Jericho missile. Using what? A steam engine? A bunch of duct tape? 24:35 into the movie, Stark and the Doctor have been working together for some time, and at this moment, he asks the Doc his name. I don't buy that. Stark is a people person. He knows how... I mean, witness the turnaround he did on the Vanity Fair reporter. He knows how to... I won't even say manipulate people. How to get the best out of people, how to charm them, how to make them feel good. He knows how to relate to people to everyone's advantage. Well, if you're a people person, you learn somebody's name. That's like the first thing you do. So that's why I'm saying I don't buy it. You still there? Oh, good. 31 minutes, 26 seconds. The terrorist leader, you have until tomorrow to assemble my missile. You know, this is an extremely delicate operation. Is rushing it going to make any sense? Well, instead of making a missile, if you haven't seen the movie, why are you watching this? So, watching, listening to, whatever. Spoiler alert. Go see the movie, then come back. I'll wait. Okay, you're back. Instead of making the missile that the terrorist leader wants, Tony Stark assembles the very first Iron Man outfit, which is fantastic. It's wonderful. I'm going to pick Nits, but I really like this movie. I'm picking Nits because it's kind of fun to do. Believe me, this does not hinder my enjoyment of the movie at all. But it is really lucky that in the 10 minutes or so it takes him to get the suit on, that nobody's watching the cameras in the room. 32 minutes, 28 seconds. It's a really cool effect. It's a really cool effect that the iron suit has a window in the chest so that this miniature arc reactor that's keeping the metal fragments out of Tony Stark's heart can shine through it. But why in the world would you bother putting a window in this suit? It takes more time. It makes it more delicate. It's an excellent target. But I will admit, it looks really cool. 32 minutes and 46 seconds. The terrorists are now looking at the cameras, and the Stark and the Doctor are working in such a way that they can't quite figure out what's going on. This is a really small room, and there's four cameras in here. How are they out of all of the shots? Now, here's one that's not just a plot oversight, but is an actual mistake. For some reason, the iron suit has to have a loading screen. They're downloading the latest version of Windows into it or something. I forget why exactly, but it's a thing. And the Doctor looks at the computer screen at 34 minutes and 19 seconds. The loading bar is just past halfway. Call it 53%. So he's like, there's not enough time. And he grabs a machine gun and runs out into the hallway on a suicide mission. Stark looks back at the loading bar, and now it's about 48%. So it went from 53% loaded to 48%. No wonder this is taking so long. It's going backwards. This terrorist complex must be huge, or else the terrorists are out at Afghanistani Starbucks, because at 34 minutes and 40 seconds, Stark's modified bomb blows out the door and takes care of those two. More than a minute goes by, and nobody shows up to check out the sound of the explosion. 34 minutes, 47 seconds. The terrorist thugs, either they're not trained very well, or maybe terrorists are really cowards. One guy, this is the Doctor, is coming at them with a machine gun, and three guys turn tail and run for it. They don't take cover, they don't return fire, they just run away. I'm no soldier, but I read a lot. That is not good training. All right, so the loading sequence that was going backwards, well, it finally finishes at 35:07. The lights go off when the loading sequence finishes, and that's really convenient because the iron suit that Tony is in was hanging on some hooks, and now he's on the ground, and they don't show us how that happened. Go, go, gadget servo actuators. 35 minutes and 27 seconds. Now, we established that the iron suit has this light on the front of it. When the terrorists finally enter the room where Tony Stark is, there's no light. So why, until the terrorist gets right in front of Stark, and then suddenly there's a light shining in his face from this 7-foot iron suit that he completely missed. Was Stark holding a hand over it or something? The light, I mean. Not the suit. 36 minutes and 10 seconds. You remember those terrorists that ran away from a guy with glasses and a machine gun? Well, now a terrorist runs straight for the 7-foot iron robot. Where was this guy a minute ago? 36 minutes and 12 seconds. Stark punches a bad guy who flies backwards through the air about 20 feet and somehow lands face first. I'm no physicist, but I think that's impossible. Alright, so the big bad terrorist, as always happens, finally decides if you're going to do something right, you have to do it yourself. And so he faces down Tony Stark in his Iron Man suit with a rocket. Tony Stark has stopped dead, makes a perfect target, the guy's firing a rocket, and yet somehow it misses. Then Stark fires a rocket right back at him, and he misses. Have they been taking lessons from the stormtroopers? They're 15 feet apart, they're firing rockets. All right, just because this happens in every movie doesn't make it unpickable. 38 minutes, 14 seconds, the middle of a firefight. Every second counts. People are trying to kill you, but Tony Stark stops for a long moment with the doctor before he passes. And everyone who is their enemy is kind enough to not fire at them or shout or set off an explosion or do anything to interrupt the moment. 38:43. The terrorists are outside the cave. They're watching the mouth of the cave. There's this vague shape coming striding forward. Boom. 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 I don't know what the booms are. They're supposed to be the sounds of Stark's feet hitting the ground, but they don't line up with his feet actually hitting the ground. 39:03. This happens in a lot of movies, too. Stark is so confident in his armor that he just stands at the mouth of the cave, letting them shoot at him for like 15 seconds. All right, his suit, okay, it's iron, and I will buy that it's bulletproof. But there are rockets attached to the suit, there's hydraulics, there's gas tanks for the flamethrowers. One lucky shot, and you are a Roman candle, Stark. 40 minutes and 10 seconds. Oh, fudgy physics time. Stark sets off these rockets that lift him into the air and away from the camp. And I'm frankly amazed that his legs don't break from the combined force of rockets versus gravity. Now, with his later Iron Man suit, his legs are completely encased, so I suppose I could buy that. But with this walking erector set, even if you buy that there's enough power to get him off the ground, how he doesn't break everything. And then, after the 100, 200-foot fall, I don't care that he's falling into sand. It is amazing that he lands in this very heavy metal suit without breaking every bone in his body. And that happens at 40 minutes and 20 seconds. But Stark has been saved, and the bad guy lives to possibly kill again, and Rhodey shows up, and he collects Stark, and they fly back to the United States, and at 42 minutes and 17 seconds, this enormous aircraft touches down, the huge back section opens, Stark and Rhodey are just standing there. Did they stand there or hang around in the cargo bay for the whole entire trip? Was this the only available plane that they could use to get him back home? 42 minutes, 20 seconds. Stark's right arm is in a sling. When he was rescued, he wasn't favoring that arm. It looks like nothing's wrong with it besides some cuts and abrasions. Why the sling? My guess is that he broke it, patting himself on the back for his fabulous escape. This one's fun, because sometimes I see something and I think it's a nit, and I don't know, like, you know, I don't know from plumbing, I don't know from much in the way of aerodynamics, I don't know from a lot of things, but I know from video cameras. And at 45:35, as Tony Stark is having his press conference, he tells everybody to sit down because he's sitting down. All right, he didn't mean the guys behind the video cameras. Well, there's a wide shot of the room, there's seven cameras, all the record lights are on, and nobody is standing behind them, which means when he gets up and starts walking, he's walking right out of the shot. And then we see Obadiah, wonderfully played by, I should have looked it up beforehand, the guy that was in Tron, in the new Tron. You know who I'm talking about. Well, it's not a movie podcast, so I'll forgive myself for not knowing his name, but you know who I mean. The guy that we think is Tony Stark's friend turns out to be the bad guy, comes swooping in on a Segway in 46 minutes, 20 seconds. And this is not a nit, it's just a note. I don't care who's on a Segway. Johnny Depp, Brad Pitt, Charlize Theron. It is impossible to ride a Segway without looking like a complete dork. So now, Stark is back. He's bad. He's just the best ever. And he's replacing his cave-made chest reactor with a much better arc reactor that he made special with all the tools at his disposal. Why does he need this appliance now? Is there no hospital in the country, no doctor qualified enough to remove the shrapnel that's threatening his life? It seems to make a lot more sense to do that than walk around the rest of your life with an unnecessary disability. And just for fun, 50 minutes and 35 seconds, it's just Stark and Pepper Potts playing Operation, playing let's get this old reactor out of me, and for whatever you do, don't pull out the magnet at the end of it, and if you do this wrong, it could kill me. No medical staff, no EMT personnel, just the two of them undergoing a very risky procedure that could cost the life of perhaps the richest and most important person on the planet. Does this bother anybody else? 51 minutes, 3 seconds. Make sure when you pull it out, you don't pull out the magnet at the end of it. How is she supposed to not do that? It's firmly attached to the wire that he asked her to remove. And then when she pulls out the magnet she's not supposed to remove, he says nothing about putting it back in. So Tony Stark has decided that he needs to take over and save the world, and he's going to make a good Iron Man suit as opposed to the Erector set he made in the cave. And so he gets these boots together, and he puts the boots on, and he sets them up to 10% thrust capacity, and it throws them into a wall, which I admit is funny. It's a funny scene. I'm not taking away from the funny, but this guy is so smart. And I know it's the point of the film is just saying, hey, he's a cowboy. I know he's a cowboy, but he's not a stupid cowboy. There's no computer simulation you can try first. No, you can't run the simulation using a mannequin. Call Rhodey over. Have him strap the boots on. But it's stupid that he's doing it this way, and he's not a stupid man. I'm just saying, Steve Jobs would never have done something like this. And he's lucky he doesn't break all his ribs the way he hits that stone wall. 59 minutes, 36 seconds. With all of his money and resources and intelligence, Stark is still testing his flight capability within feet of several very expensive and beautiful automobiles. And I just want to, you know, speak out for the automobiles that have done nothing to him and that he is risking. This part of the film made me very nervous. That's all I'm saying. All right. 1 hour, 2 minutes, 32 seconds. I'm going to get this off my chest. It almost won the Will Award. And the only reason it didn't is because I'm not 100% certain of my science, but I'm pretty sure, and I have an actual rocket scientist, my friend Stephen Rhodes, backing me up. Flight is possible because of the Bernoulli principle. The quick and dirty explanation is that when there are more molecules underneath a wing than there are on top, the pressure of those molecules forces the wing up. Don't believe me? Ask your local scientist. The wing shape is very important. That's why, you know, you throw a frisbee with the same effort that you throw, say, a brick, frisbee's going to go further. The brick does not have a wing shape. I hope I'm not getting too technical here. That's not a fair example because the brick and the frisbee weigh differently. So I'm going to try right this second to think of a better example, something with similar weight. If you throw a frisbee the way a frisbee is meant to be thrown, and you're visualizing it right now, it goes the way a frisbee goes. Take that same frisbee, put your hand on the underside, and then throw it forward like the way you would push a pie into somebody's face. It is not going to go the same distance. No way it will go the same distance. Why? Because of air resistance and because of the shape. So wings are important. And I'm patting myself on the back for that example because that was good. So you'll notice I keep using the word wing. Every aircraft, from the Wright Brothers Flyer to the P-52 Mustang to helicopters to 747s to those flight suits that we see in the second Tomb Raider movie, they're called wing suits because they have a wing-like surface. Everything that gets up in the air has some sort of wing, with the exception of like jetpacks, and you'll notice in jetpack things, they pretty much go up and down. You watch actual jetpack tests, the operator doesn't so much lean forward. Even in the Rocketeer, his helmet, they're like, well, he's got this thing on his helmet, and that's, even that, they attempted to make wing-like. The one thing the Iron Man suit does not have is anything even slightly resembling a wing. I'll buy that the miniature arc reactor has enough power to keep Stark alive and power the suit, and that they don't, there's no need for fuel, because it would be really difficult. Where are you going to put fuel in the Iron Man suit? That does make me wonder what the flames are that are coming out of his boots if the thing doesn't need fuel. And if it does, where is he keeping it? But anyway, what I don't buy for a moment is that without wings, it is possible for Stark to have any control over his trajectory. Thank you and good night. 1 hour, 3 minutes in, Stark is going for a joyride, and the suit camera goes in for a super close-up of a kid on a Ferris wheel. And I just want to say this camera is absolutely fantastic. I know they have cameras that are drones that you can set it up and throw it into the air and it will follow somebody like down a ski slope, which must really suck for guys that make their living filming skiers. But anyway, I know drones are capable of that, but it's really truly amazing if you look at this shot that with the speed that he's trucking along, the super tight shot on this kid in the Ferris wheel is unmoving. It's absolutely steady. That technology is remarkable. We've established that Stark is a cowboy and that sometimes he's really stupid. Here's another moment. At 1 hour, 3 minutes, 20 seconds in, Stark decides, I'm going to break the world's fixed-wing flight record. And I don't even have wings. He has no idea how he's going to deal with the cold. He has no idea how long his power will last. He has no idea how he's going to land if everything fails. This is really stupid. And then at 1 hour, 4 minutes, 50 seconds, he falls into his garage onto a Shelby Cobra. And I'm saying it better be a kit that they destroyed and not a real Shelby Cobra, because there are only so many of those in the world. What did that car do to anybody? Can't they smush a Chevelle or something? 1 hour, 4 minutes, 54 seconds after his successful, in quotes, test flight, Stark is holding a bag of ice to his head. Why his head? He fell through 3 floors of his house, but his head didn't hit anything. 1 hour, 7 minutes, 50 seconds. Something movies do a lot, and Mystery Science Theater 3000 has made fun of it, is when the hero happens to turn on the radio or the TV and suddenly hears information that they really needed that they wouldn't have known if they hadn't suddenly turned on the radio or the TV. And it happens here when Stark turns the TV on and he hears about the third annual benefit that he was supposed to attend that he's forgotten about. I'm going to tell on myself. 1 hour, 8 minutes, 48 seconds. I should probably turn in my comic book geek secret decoder ring. Yes, of course I have a comic book geek secret decoder ring. Try to keep up. I never realized when I first saw the movie that Strategic Homeland Intervention Enforcement and Logistics Division is acronymed into SHIELD. I mean, it's right there, and I totally, totally missed it. For the record, the comics had it a little differently. Still spelled SHIELD, but they didn't have Homeland in the name. No, I'm not going to tell you what it was. Go look it up. You're a big boy or a girl. 1 minute, 15:17. Kudos where kudos are deserved. As a comic book geek, I have to say the robotic assembly of the Iron Man suit, that's one of the coolest cinematic moments ever. But it does lend itself to a nit. We'll get back to that later. 1 hour, 15 minutes, 58 seconds. Iron Man has learned that there's trouble in a far-off country. So he flies from California halfway around the world to bring justice to this village in the desert. I suppose it's not a nit. I suppose there's some way that he had enough fuel to make the flight, and he can somehow fly despite the lack of anything resembling a wing. Can you imagine how boring that flight would be? What are we talking, 8, 10 hours? Does his heads-up display come with in-flight movies? Even if the suit can manage, 1,000 miles an hour, and I really doubt it can, that's still like a 10-hour flight. So Iron Man has saved the villagers. He takes off in search of his errant Jericho missiles, and a tank round blindsides him. 1 hour, 18 minutes, 33 seconds. Maybe a little less time spent deciding what color the suit should be and a little more time including some radar in the suit would have been a good idea. Or just look around occasionally. I mean, I'm just saying, my robotic suit doesn't look nearly as cool as Iron Man's, but it totally has radar. 1 hour, 18 minutes, 48 seconds. The tank fires at Iron Man again, and he dodges out of the way. Some would say that's impossible, but anyway. Then, strangely enough, the round the tank fires off must have gone off into space, because we never hear it actually hit anything. And this was in the trailer. Everybody saw it. 1 hour, 18 minutes, 55 seconds. The tank has fired at him twice, so he's going to fire back, and he's got a rocket about the size of a carrot. It hits the tank, and then the tank totally explodes. What was in that rocket that caused that much damage? I mean, it's a fun moment. It's like the old Indiana Jones with the whip thing. But, I don't really buy it. I suppose there's a lot of things I don't buy. I really do love this movie. I cannot state enough. It's a fun movie. It's just, I like picking nits. 1 hour, 19 minutes, 56 seconds. Edwards Air Force Base picks up Iron Man as an unidentified radar contact. We'll set aside the fact that he's been in that suit flying across the ocean for hours, and apparently they didn't catch him then. But anyway, of all people, guess who's the weapons designer that's suddenly in the room with him? It's Rhodey! What are the odds? 1 hour, 20 minutes, 18 seconds. What are we dealing with here? This is one of the soldiers asking Rhodey. Well, let me make a call. Yeah, that's my best Rhodey. Somehow, because Stark told Rhodey he was working on something big, Rhodey figures, you know what? I bet I know who's in that unidentified flying object. It's a bit of a stretch, logic-wise. So, 1 hour, 21 minutes, 40 seconds, Iron Man is dealing with the U.S. Air Force. This suit can fly, quote-unquote, in any direction. Why does he keep going straight forward as they're firing missiles and bullets and such? Does the term evasive maneuvers mean anything to the incredibly intelligent Tony Stark? I'm asking. 1 minute, 22 seconds, No. 1 hour, 22 seconds. Let's try this for a third time. 1 hour, 22 minutes, 50 seconds. I'm here all week. Iron Man is clinging to a fighter plane, doing hundreds of miles an hour, and then when he's thrown off, he breaks through the other jet's wing. He doesn't break. The wing breaks. That is one heck of a suit. Iron Man, there's a pilot who has to eject, and he can't get his chute open, and Iron Man is going to save him. Luckily, Tony Stark knows just where to punch and rip and claw to get the falling pilot's chute to open. I'm just saying that's really specific information. Did he design the ejector seat? Well, did he? Obadiah has been revealed as a bad guy, and he's using an ultrasonic device to give the terrorist bad guy a brain freeze. But he's unaffected, Obadiah is, because of these blue glowing earplugs. Now, as near as I can tell, and I've looked carefully, 1 hour, 27 minutes, 48 seconds, he's not wearing those blue glowing earplugs right up until the moment he pulls out the ultrasonic device. And this is, again, I've never been a soldier, but I'd like to think I know a little something about tactics, because, again, I read a lot. 1 hour, 28 minutes, 10 seconds, Obadiah tells his supporting soldiers to kill all the terrorist bad guys. The supporting soldiers are drawn on the terrorist bad guys in a circle. There's a reason why when people do firing squads, they line them up against a wall. Because if you're standing in a circle and then you go to shoot people, the odds of hitting somebody on the other side of the circle are really good. So don't do it. Pepper Potts is trying to get the goods on Obadiah, reveal him to be a bad guy. So she sneaks into Stark's office and hopes that Obadiah won't catch her. 1 hour, 31 minutes, 58 seconds. On his computer, there's a video from the terrorists, and since she doesn't speak their language, he types translate into the computer. Now, this is maybe a bit far-fetched. It's really cool. The computer immediately switches the audio to English. Doesn't even take a second, just switches it. Doesn't put up closed captioning, just switches the audio to English. The really amazing part is the person who was previously speaking in the non-English language also recorded the English translation. The terrorists were kind enough to send the video with an embedded English audio track. I'm not saying it's impossible, I'm just saying it's really thoughtful. when screenwriters write, "This paralyzes the hero," I imagine people, the actor reading it, is like, oh man, because it's really tough to act paralysis. And as much as I love Junior here, oh my goodness, who plays Iron Man? Who plays Tony Stark? No, I'm going to look it up. You can sit there waiting. Oh, man, that's going to bug me. I want to say Mitt Romney Jr., and that's not right. Da, 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 da. So how are you doing? Are you good? Robert Downey Jr. Right, Mitt Romney Jr. Anyway, Robert Downey Jr., he does his best to be paralyzed, but 1 hour, 36 minutes, 20 seconds, this paralyzed head moves from one shot to the next, and then moves again, 1 hour, 36 minutes, 33 seconds from looking straight ahead to looking right. Even though he's paralyzed, he's moving around a lot, and still blinking, and still breathing. I wonder if there... I think there are, like, poisons that cause paralysis. Wouldn't they keep you from breathing? It's just convenient that in the movies you can paralyze people so they can't move, but they never die, or seem to. Anyway... the reason why Stark has been paralyzed is so that Obadiah the Evil can remove the mini arc reactor. This is a one-of-a-kind, built specifically for one-purpose device. It seems really strange to me that Obadiah can pull this nifty tool out of his bag that just yanks the arc reactor out of Stark's chest like a cork from a bottle. I could see Stark deliberately designing a tool that would remove the arc reactor, but why would he give it away? 139.57, the constantly befuddled robot finally comes through, the one that he was going to donate to a city college. He pulls down the glass-encased original arc reactor that Pepper Potts gave to Stark so that his life could be saved. I'm thankful. I don't want to complain that it happened. I just find it really amazing that the robot knew that Stark somehow needed it, even though there were no voice commands involved. And that Stark could get himself down the stairs despite short-term paralysis. So Tony Stark has got his Iron Man suit up and running, and he's going to take out Obadiah in his big silver suit. Isn't it interesting that Obadiah's big silver suit also has this giant light on the chest, which, why would you design that if it doesn't need it? I'd say, so you need an arc reactor to power it. Why not make it so you can't see that light? It's just such a good target, I'm saying. And it's a very vulnerable target, because if the arc reactor goes, it's just a really, really, really heavy paperweight. You know, imagine trying to walk around strapped to, say, a car. Here's the thing. I told you I'd get back to this. When Stark first put on his amazing Iron Man suit, the process took 48 or so seconds. Either the robotics get quicker with experience, or Stark changed his suit-up setting from dramatic to urgent, because this time it only takes about 15 seconds. 1 hour, 42 minutes, 48 seconds. Rhodey looks up at the quickly disappearing figure of Iron Man, then over at the original silver suit, and he's like, next time. And A, well, next time's going to be Don Cheadle. But, and if that was a nod to Iron Man 2, they did it well. But considering that the suit you're looking at doesn't have a power supply, I don't think you would get very far in it. See previous comment about walking around strapped to a car. So Pepper Potts goes to the compound looking for Tony Stark. She wants to rescue him. She knows that Obadiah is the bad guy. Obadiah is in his big suit. He's waiting for her to turn and look in his direction. 1 hour, 44 minutes, 4 seconds, and then he turns the suit's eye lights on and starts raising to his full height. This guy really has a flair for the dramatic, because if you think about it, he's been standing hunched over in the dark just so he can make a good impression. Here we're getting down to the nitty-gritty. 1 hour, 44 minutes, 50 seconds. The big suit punches his way up from underground. Kind of makes you wonder what he was standing on, that he could do that. But anyway, as he comes out, he growls menacingly. Is Obadiah sitting in there growling into a microphone? Or does the robot have some sort of menacing software, like GRR 3.5, maybe? I've mentioned James Bond movies before. This is another trope that happens to James Bond a lot, and if I'm honest, also Batman. 1 hour, 51 minutes, 25 seconds. Obadiah has Tony Stark in his sights. He's got him dead to rights. One bullet, it's over. Our hero is dangling helplessly. Obadiah has hundreds of bullets, which he wastes, shooting out all the glass in the roof rather than hitting our hero. Somehow Stark miraculously is not hurt at all. He couldn't go back for the sequel if they killed him, so... And finally, one last little bit. Stark saves the day, as you knew he would. And he goes to talk to Agent Coulson. Agent Coulson tells Stark to stick to the script and finishes with, you've got 90 seconds. What is Coulson looking at? There's no clock in the room. He doesn't have a watch on. He looks at nothing. Is he accessing some internal memory system? SHIELD agents are really robots. That's how he survived dying in the Avengers movie. Pass it on! Hopefully this is fun. For you, I know I'm having a fun time. Go back and watch these movies and look for your own nits. And if you find something that I didn't mention, send me an email, videoninja@juno.com, or write it in the comments. If you have the time and are enjoying these podcasts, feel free to leave an iTunes review, because, frankly, I could use them. But more than anything, A, come back in 2 weeks and we will look at Return of the Jedi, which will be fun for nitpicking. And also, even more importantly, own your stage, huh? Because it's the only one you've got. I'll go work on owning mine, and we will see you back here in a couple weeks. Christmas is here, bring your cheer to young and old, make it the book. Christmas is here.
to every home.
Dawn on this and on without end, their joyful tone to every home.